Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to the 19th instalment of Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. It's Tuesday, June 26, and we've got another top podcast for you this week. If you're a first-time listener, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast using the links to the left of the main posts. You can use iTunes or whatever podcatcher you'd like. On today's show, we'll hear from the Chief Executive of Fair Isaac, Dr. Mark Green. Fair Isaac, among other things, makes anti-fraud software used by the banks. Some of you may have heard of their anti-fraud system, Falcon. He'll be along soon to talk about the role of analytics software in detecting illegal activities. But first, as always, it's time to check in with Munir Katadia, ZDNet Australia's resident IT security blogger and reporter, for this week's security news. So, Munir, I guess the first bit of news we've got this week is the Pentagon getting owned.
Yeah, that's right. We've had reports all over the place saying 15,000 accounts have been taken offline. They say they're not they haven't revealed any military operations, though.
Yeah, but I always imagine, you know, when you always hear of these breaches into unclassified systems, which is what they're claiming, it was an unclassified mail system, but you'd imagine you'd gather a fair bit of decent intel even by examining unclassified mail washing around the Pentagon, wouldn't you?
You'd think so, but I tell you what, it's a bit strange because on our UK site they covered this and they said the Defence Secretary, Robert Gates, said he didn't use email because he was very low-tech. So I think the guys really high up actually just talk to each other.
Quite makes sense in this age of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Now, look, here's a bit of good news, and we don't get to see this very often, but security vendors claim to be beating pump-and-dump scams, like through spam. You know, you get all those spams for penny stocks saying, buy now, it's about to skyrocket. And they reckon it used to account for 50% of spam, and now it accounts to just 5%.
Yeah, and it's come down just since the beginning of this year. So, I mean, I don't know. You look at this and you think, well, what could it be? Because, first of all, they changed them from text-based ones to, you know, image spam, and then they were doing all sorts of other little tricks. And now maybe it's just education people have finally realized that, hang on a second, if we do this, we're just helping them and we're probably not going to get anything out of it anyway. So I think it took a few burnt fingers before people stopped going along with them.
Well, yeah, but you got to love how the vendors actually claim credit for this.
Well, they have to, don't they? It's their job. They must have had something to do with it. I mean, you know, they're the ones that were calling up all the administrators saying, oi, you've got to buy our stuff to, like, stop this kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, I wonder how much of it's to do with just people being more educated about this and how much of it is to do with technical measures like anti-spam software.
Yeah, I guess we can, like, probably share it out between the two.
Yeah, all right. That'll make them happy as long as they get partial credit. Now, you know, we were talking last week about how we're reporting on Apple bugs every week, and, yep, we've had another one come through.
Yeah, that's right. Do you reckon it's time that they did move officially to a monthly patch cycle?
Yeah, look, it might make sense. You know, it seems that the deluge of bugs in, you know, Apple's operating system has begun. So, but then again, I mean, it's not really an operating system that's used in the commercial, you know, the corporate sort of sphere.
Yeah.
You know, with Windows, I think the reason they moved to a patching cycle is because, you know, patching 1,000 workstations at unpredictable intervals was getting to be a serious pain in the ass for a lot of admins out there.
Yeah, I
don't think there's that same driver for Mac OS X. But then again, a little bit of predictability might help the companies out there that actually use Macs.
But, you know, I guess there's good and bad points in all of this, isn't there? I mean, if there is a serious vulnerability, even Microsoft steps out of its patching cycle, maybe Apple's just trying to patch these as quick as they come in. It's just, you know, I hope they're not getting overwhelmed here.
Yeah, well, I think we all do, especially us Mac users. Now,
yes.
turns out, now this is a little interesting sort of technical tidbit here. We've had PHP exploit code buried inside GIF files that actually winds up being exploited on the server when someone views the image.
Yeah, I heard that this was actually put onto one of the major photo sharing sites, but I haven't been able to find out which one it was. You got any idea about that?
It's interesting, isn't it, that it wasn't named, and the impression I get is that maybe they're still battling with eradicating this particular vulnerability, so they didn't want to let the cat out of the bag. Well, that's one anyway for any of the really sort of hardcore pen testers and geeks out there to look into. I'm sure they're already all over it, but
yeah
interesting. You know, it's sort of like exploit stenography, you know. It's
yeah.
It's very, very cool stuff. Now, we've got the government claiming that the national ID card is not a national ID card. Their $1.09 billion access card will not be used as a national identity card, they're saying.
It's hysterical. What they should say is that should never, ever, under any circumstances, be referred to as an ID card. But yeah. We all know that's what it really is.
I remember interviewing the spokesperson for Chris Ellison several years ago about this, and they said, well, no, it's not an ID card. I said, well, no, it's a... I guess it's just a card that you use to identify yourself with. That's not an ID card. I mean,
how did he take that?
Oh, it was a she, and she actually had a bit of a wry chuckle. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's almost become an in-joke within government circles. It's like, you know, they've ditched the Work Choices brand as well. You know, there's just certain unmentionables with this current administration, and calling the access card an ID card is one of them.
It's still, like, you know, moving through, and it's going to happen, and I don't think it matters what they call it, and even if, you know, they actually end up admitting it, they just seem to have the power to push these things through.
Well, of course they do. They've got Senate majority, but Ellison's saying that the bill is clearly going to, you know, outlaw the use of the ID card. It will be illegal for anyone to demand it as a form of identification, but when it is such a robust form of identification, I imagine that it will make life so much easier for people who are using it as a form of identification that it will become the de facto standard anyway.
Yeah, no, I'll go with you there, for sure.
So, yeah, a little more politics there. We've seen an arrest in Spain over a 28-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of creating and spreading a virus that affected more than 115,000 high-end mobile phones. Now, we've just been talking in the last few weeks about how mobile is going to be the next frontier. It's going to be the next big sort of hot topic for 2007, and whammo, we've seen an arrest.
Well, do you know, I'm not surprised. One thing I'm surprised is that this report has got 115,000 have been infected. I've been trying, you know, I was in a pub going back about a year and a half or so, and we were just sitting there, and the friend's mobile phone started going crazy and saying, accept this message. And it was a Symbian phone. And, you know, she was like pressing, no. And in the end, oh, sod this, and pressed yes. The machine just completely died. And I don't know which one it was, but it was one of the Bluetooth ones. It could possibly have been this.
Well, this is what it's saying. It's a Bluetooth-enabled phone. So it's not actually, doesn't look like it actually spreads over the telephone network. It spreads from phone to phone.
These things are out there, and it's quite scary. And it's good that this guy got put away, but I'm sure there's more out there. Luckily, people have got quite smart with their Bluetooth. And now when you get a phone, you know, you have to switch the Bluetooth on, and it only lasts for a minute or so. And those kind of preventive measures have really, really helped us. But, you know, I mean, the technology is out there for these things to spread. So I guess things like airports and crowded sporting arenas and those kind of places are going to be the most dangerous place.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you can imagine that if you get infected by this thing, it's going to sit there trying to, you know, propagate. You know, you might jump on a plane, take it to another country, and whammo, you're infecting people in Botswana.
Yeah, totally.
You never know.
Are you planning any trips there?
I don't know. Soon. You know, in a bit of just plain disgusting news, the United States judiciary has imprisoned an Australian man for copyright infringement for 51 months. Now, this is Hugh Griffiths.
Drink or Die, right?
Drink or Die, yeah, the piracy ring. I mean, this guy never profited from his crimes, and the Australian government served him up for extradition to the United States, despite the fact that he hadn't even been to the United States.
He's never been there, no, but
and we have
international laws, yeah.
Yeah, but we have the same laws in Australia. He could have been tried through this system. I mean, we had a solicitor on the podcast a few weeks ago, Aaron Karabardak from the firm Cooper Mills in Melbourne, just saying that, I mean, he's no expert in extraditions, but it does seem quite odd that he was just served up to the Americans to be tried in a foreign country with no support, no lawyers, no nothing, when he could clearly have been tried under compatible legislation within Australia.
I think this is a sign that shows the Americans can do anything they like.
Yeah, well,
it's quite scary.
He's been in prison for years, you know, awaiting his trial, and now he's going to have to spend, I think it's another 15 months in jail in a foreign country for a crime that he committed in Australia. It just beggars belief, doesn't it?
It is. It's quite scary. But, I mean, you know, a lot of stuff that's going on over there, over the pond, is quite scary at the moment. And
But the fact that Australians, you know, who might be engaged in these sort of activities, and, you know, I'm certainly not one to condone these sort of activities, but the idea that they can commit a crime in Australia and then be judged by, you know, by a foreign government and actually just served up on a platter by our government, I mean, it is an utterly, utterly piss-weak move, isn't it?
It is, totally, totally.
It just sort of leaves a bad taste in your mouth, especially with all of this stuff around, you know, David Hicks and whatnot being whizzed off to Guantanamo Bay. It just seems like when the US says jump, the Australian government says how high.
Yeah, and it's not just the Australian government either.
No. Well, on that cheery note, Mania.
We always end these with a really high mark.
Now, I understand you're in Melbourne this week, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I'm here at the Remix thing with Microsoft, showing off Silverlight and all those kind of things.
I have no idea what that is.
Well, hopefully I'll find out over the next few days and report back.
Excellent, okay. Well, Mania, as always, thank you very much for your time this week, especially considering you're on the road.
Okay, no worries. It's a pleasure as always. Cheers, mate.
That was Mania Katadia with this week's news. We'll be right back in 15 seconds.
Web security is hot, and security vendor Sophos is leading the charge to block networks against web-based spyware, viruses, malware, and unwanted applications at the gateway. To find out more, go to sophos.com.au. Sophos, security and control for safe and productive web browsing.
Now it's time for this week's feature interview. Dr. Mark Green has recently taken the helm of US-based company Fair Isaac as the group's chief executive. He was in Australia last week to meet with high-value clients and get a feel for the Australian market. Fair Isaac is big on anti-fraud software. Even if some mug has given away their internet banking username and password through some sort of phishing scam, with any luck, Fair Isaac's fraud detection software, Falcon, used on the bank's end, will be able to figure out that the subsequent login attempts and transactions are in fact bogus. Dr. Green spoke to Risky Business by phone from Sydney last week.
We use analytics and something called predictive sciences to help firms model what's going on with their customers to help them stay out of trouble, but also to improve service to their clients and understand opportunities for growing their business with their clients through selling additional products.
Now, this is one of the interesting things is, I suppose, the failure of the IT industry to appropriately secure computers or at least make them easy to secure has made this sort of analytics and transaction-based anomaly detection much more important, hasn't it?
Well, you're correct that a portion of what we benefit from is the need for enhanced security. What we're really trying to do with our analytics is help our clients serve their clients better. So whether that's eliminating fraud and risk or growing the service levels or looking for opportunities to sell additional products to them, the analytics can do all of those things. And what we call enterprise decision management, which is powered by these analytics, is really the opportunity for our clients to know what they know about their customers and make smart decisions so that they better serve their clients. Security is one portion of it, but it's hardly the entirety of the story.
So you wouldn't say that it's the main selling point for your analytics?
It depends a little bit where you are in the business cycle. For instance, here in Australia, prior to the rollout of EMV in the credit card industry, there were quite a few risks that we helped a number of our clients.
I'm sorry, EMV?
EMV is a standard that the credit card agencies rolled out, which by the credit card agencies themselves helped to reduce security concerns.
Okay.
And prior to that, we had quite a bit of opportunity here in Australia to help banks. But we still have opportunities, not so much in the security area, but in other forms of knowing their customers since the advent of EMV a few years ago.
How is it that something, I mean, I understand it's the Falcon product,
yes,
is one of your big...
That's correct. Falcon has analytics which basically look for anomalous transactions. So Falcon begins to model what is a usual kind of pattern of transaction for you. I actually have a humorous personal anecdote to tell you here. I'm in the process of moving my family from New York to our corporate headquarters in Minneapolis. As a result, I'm buying and selling houses on both ends and quite a bit of financial transactions taking place. So much so that the other day in the middle of a transaction, my bank suspended my account. Mm. It turns out that bank uses our own Falcon software, and what the software was recognizing is that I had exceeded the profile, the threshold for how many and what types of transactions I normally do, so potential fraud was suspected.
I must confess I had a similar problem in Germany recently when I was trying to pay my rent.
Right.
And alas, I was locked out of my banking session. I imagine that it's similar sort of...
That's correct, but you can appreciate where that's a good thing, especially if it's easy for the bank to then reset your account and let you back in once you're identified as the proper user, right?
Yeah, so look a couple of emails later and it was all sorted out.
Exactly right. So that's how our software works. And 91 of the world's top 100 banks use the Falcon product for that purpose, including all 7 of the top banks here in Australia.
It seems that most banks, you know, around the world are rolling out two-factor authentications. There's even a legislative requirement in the United States for two-factor authentication, isn't there?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we've gone quite that far here, but banks are voluntarily doing it because I think they're, you know, hemorrhaging a fair bit of money due to fraud. How much of the solution in the future to particularly computer-enabled fraud do you think will come from analytics, and how much of it will come from you know, technology-based solutions like, you know, smart cards or tokens or SMS-based authentication?
As I answer the question, let me first point out that actually the fraud rate in Australia is quite good. Australian financial institutions do a very good job today of managing fraud, and it's among the lowest rates of fraud that we see in the banking industry around the world. So the extent of the problem here is well under control. It's not a severe problem. Having said that, I think there is a mixture of the two things you posed that are the keys going forward. On the one hand, you need good, sound IT security, right? You need positive identification. Two-factor authentication may play a role down the road, but certainly also analytics can help. So it's a mixture of having good controls, such as authentication models, as well as adaptive analytics that understand anomalous transactions and look for things that appear to be irregular. Australia is among the leaders in having them manage, especially online kinds of fraud. So what you typically worry about here is internet fraud and electronic channel fraud, and Australia is a leader in that regard, having very low rates of fraud.
Which countries are among the worst? Who are the top offenders?
One often cites some of the Eastern European countries as having problems here, and I wouldn't care to name specific names. So some of the Eastern European bloc is associated with fraud here.
Can you tell me, Dr. Green, what your expansion plans are in Australia specifically? I mean, how many staff will you take on? What sort of roles will they be fulfilling?
We're approximately 10 domestic employees today, and looking to roughly double that in the coming months. But we support our clients here with quite a range of resources from across the Asia-Pacific region. We have several hundred, close to 400 or 500 employees in the Asia-Pacific, and a good number of them support Australian clients out of offices that we have in Singapore, Bangalore, and elsewhere. So while we're adding more staff here locally, we already have pretty good support for those customers from our Asian service centers.
Now, look, on last week's podcast, I'd done an interview with Howard Schmidt, who was describing sort of his early experiences with computer-enabled fraud and ID theft in particular. Yes. Now, it seems like the issues that we were dealing with in 1986 are very much the same issues that we're dealing with now. And you say that Fair Isaac has a 50-year history. What was Fair Isaac doing 50 years ago?
50 years ago, we weren't so much worried about security risk because, of course, there wasn't the internet. What we were worried about was beginning to understand creditworthiness of people. So not so much who you are, but assuming that you are who you claim to be, are you a good risk? So we developed a set of scorecards and models, and in the States there's something known as the FICO score, which is a numerical representation of the creditworthiness of individuals. So that's actually how the company got its start, was thinking about should you lend money to this individual, and if so, how much? And that's expanded into related offerings such as, are you really who you claim to be? That's the identity fraud point that you're raising.
Now, I suppose, does Fair Isaac have any interest in, you know, seeing federated identity actually work on a large scale?
Sure. We benefit in any environment where the person on the other end of the line can be trusted and their identity is not in question. Because we are then able to provide the rest of our capabilities around scoring and analytics. Now that I know who you are, I'm able to run the rest of my software portfolio. So federated identities is one way of accomplishing that, and of course we would be supportive of that.
It doesn't seem like federated identity is actually happening, though, at least in Australia.
Yeah, I think that's probably true in most places, and there's a number of reasons for that, having to do with the need for cooperation among vendors, the need for better standards, and not trivially something that we spend a lot of time on, concerns about privacy. Protecting sensitive customer information is paramount here. And there are at least optical, if you will, sort of visual concerns around protecting identity in the area of federated identities, because if there's a compromise of that, then the concern would be that people's identity are compromised on a broad scale.
Now, you mentioned that you worked for IBM, and you're relatively new to Fair Isaac. So you've actually come from a technology background, not a banking background, is that right?
I come from both, actually. I'm an economist by training, and I worked first at the Federal Reserve in Washington and then at Citibank for a number of years. Before joining IBM's organization 12 years ago. And I did two things there. I ran the security software business and for the last 5 or 6 years ran the banking industry vertical for IBM. So I have a mixture of the two. And I guess the way I describe myself is as a financial technologist, which is a pretty good description also of Fair Isaac.
You were speaking before about, you know, detecting anomalous transactions. What are the top five sort of giveaways for an anomalous transaction?
Well, there are many parameters that we look at in our fraud detection. So on electronic channels, of course, you look for simple things like unusual IP addresses. You look for bursty traffic or volumes of communication that are unusual. But in any channel, you look for transactions that are either of different frequency than you're used to, of different value or volume that you're used to, and that involve counterparties that are irregular. So we have at least a dozen parameters that our Falcon software uses to identify patterns that appear anomalous. The important thing here is to recognize that legitimate transactions may change over time. And so the Falcon models that we have that look for these kinds of irregularities are themselves adaptive. They learn over time so that as your patterns of legitimate transactions change, Falcon keeps up with you and doesn't begin to flag something as unusual when in fact it simply represents natural evolution in the way that you're doing business.
Do you count the large four banks in Australia among your clients?
We count three of the large four as our clients at Falcon. And we count all seven of the top seven banks as far as the customers in some portion of our portfolio.
Can you tell me also what the bad guys are doing to counter Falcon? I imagine that they're trying to work on techniques for extracting money from compromised accounts by, you know, tricking your analytics.
They do, and the new evolution there in financial fraud is similar to what you see in computer security fraud, which is organized attacks from multiple parts, right? So this is the conventional security IT terms, this is called the distributed denial of service attack, where you have multiple people in different locations trying to attack the same entity at various points in time. We see similar things happening in financial fraud, where it's not one person trying to compromise an identity or financial relationship, it's multiple parties. And so increasingly, we are having to look across channels and across financial institutions at multi-party fraud. And we have a good stable of people to do this. We have some 350 analytic scientists at FairIsaac around the world who keep active and current with those new patterns of fraud and are continuously updating our software to respond.
Any specific tricks that you can name?
The specific tricks are to look for multi-party and multi-channel fraud, which is complex because you can't spot it in one transaction. You have to look for patterns. They're doing what I say. They're organizing transactions that are multiple parts. So, you know, okay. Transfer balances from A to B to C under different names, under different financial institutions, through different channels, right? So it's no longer the case that one person comes in on a single transaction and purports to be John Smith when, in fact, there's somebody else. That was the old-fashioned form of fraud. The new-fashioned form of fraud is a series of transactions that individually look fairly innocuous but add up over time to something that is not legal.
So I guess they've had to alter their tactics to make sure that what they're doing looks innocuous to analytics packages. Have they had have they forced you guys to update your analytics to sort of counter their countering?
We regularly update our analytics. So we are right now in the sixth version of our Falcon fraud product, and there's a sixth major version, and there are continually minor updates to it along the way. So this is not a game of standing still. This has always been a business of needing to adapt and update your technology.
So I guess we could use that old cliche that it's an arms race.
I suppose that's true, yes.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we always thought that we were fighting fraudsters just on the technology playing field, but it looks like we're fighting them in the sort of, you know, financial business process end as well. Is that a fair assessment?
Right. I think that's fair. And I can update my last answer to you by telling you that here in Australia, we're on the fourth generation of our fraud models. So the software itself globally is on the sixth generation software, but we've been through four generations of fraud models specific to the Australian marketplace.
So you actually have to come up with fraud models that are specific to each region that you're operating.
That's correct, reflecting the unique financial arrangements in a given country and sometimes specific patterns of fraud that we see country by country as well.
Dr. Green, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
As regular listeners know, this podcast is sponsored by CyberTrust. So each week, we like to have a CyberTrust representative on the show to talk about an industry trend. This week, it's Paul Nevin who's along to discuss security event management software.
Security event management, also known as security incident management, is basically any technology that is used to process security data. And it does so by filtering out the high value or high risk events for a security analyst to investigate.
Now, look, I'm going to use one of the most annoying words that you can possibly encounter in security, and it's holistic, okay? It's one of those ones that's right up there with, you know, not a silver bullet. It's right up there with it raises the bar. But it is – when you've got your SEM data, you're capturing everything from routers to clients to servers, and it really does give you a nice big picture view of what's going on, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of security value in effectively the log data from almost any device, but the challenge is in getting that log data and processing it. And a lot of organizations have realized that the volume of log data they're seeing, in some cases it might be 50 million or more events a day, you cannot staff a team to analyze that information. You must turn to some form of automated tool in order to get the value out of that log data, and SEM technology is that tool.
Well, it's sort of interesting too, because you can find yourself in a situation where you're looking at a lot of relatively benign data from individual sources, but once you actually correlate them, you might start to see a picture emerging of some nastier behavior. Is that right?
That's right. You might see a single event from, say, a firewall or an IPS that looks suspicious, and alone that event may not be indicative of a particular attack, but if you look at further evidence from your another firewall, another router, maybe the host OS has log data on it, you can look at all those events and come up with a concept of the particular attack.
Now, how popular are SEM tools out there in the enterprise market in Australia?
They're gaining traction. I think the main problem at the moment is not everyone understands where to apply this technology. It's often seen among management as a silver bullet, but the reality is...
Oh, you said it.
I said it. A very skilled, very knowledgeable security analyst must be placed in front of this tool to get value out of it. It's not something you put in place and simply walk away from.
But don't you think that's almost a drawback of the technology? Shouldn't anyone really be able to sit in front of such a sophisticated tool and know what's going on?
Well, the problem is that the sophistication of the attacks is such that they're constantly evolving. They need someone who can understand those attacks and understand how they evolve in order to detect them. And no tool, no technology that we've seen to date has that ability. A human still must be involved.
Surely we'll get there, though, within the next few years.
I would like to think that our SEM technology becomes more efficient. We will be able to prioritise those alerts which are most valuable to an analyst, but I think most ultimately we would make the determination of the threat level. All the tools in the world won't be able to take away the value that the security analyst actually brings in the equation.
Now, I saw some stuff demoed to me by Marty Roach of Snort and Sourcefire fame a few years ago, and that looked, I can't remember the name of the tool that he was demoing, but it was pretty amazing stuff. It was, you know, it had the whole GUI and, you know, it was very pretty. Who are the vendors making the biggest push into the SEM space?
A large number of them. Sourcefire, of course, have their products. Very, very nice looking products, actually. There's also IntelliTactics, another company out of Canada. There are a large number of them out there, all producing tools that will allow you to correlate the threats in your environment against the security events you're seeing, largely automating the process that you had to do manually previously.
Okay, well, Paul Nevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for another edition of Risky Business. Don't forget to check out itradio.com.au's other weekly podcast, A Series of Tubes with Ian Yates, which updates on the site every Wednesday. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.